The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
China is rapidly emerging as the global technology superpower, outpacing the United States across most critical innovation areas, from AI and robotics to batteries and quantum computing. State-backed investment and strategic planning are driving an unprecedented surge in scientific output and industrial capacity. Joining me now to talk about what China is doing right, Dennis Staunton, China correspondent of the Irish Times. Dennis, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
What is it like living in China today? Is it like living in the future, or are there remnants of the past visible?
It's kind of both in a way. There are certain things about it that are very futuristic. It's there's the embrace of technology. The fact that all of the cities are almost everywhere in every city is very new. Something like 88% or almost 90% of the housing was built after 1990. And in fact, most of it, like 70%, was built after the year 2000. So everything is new. And obviously, they've embraced technology in a way that there's the use of, say, facial recognition to enter places, the seamless way in which you just pay for everything by showing your phone rather than using credit cards or cash or anything like that. So there is that. And yet, on the other hand, there's a kind of an old-fashioned quality about it, partly because the society is very traditional in many ways, in that, for example, the families are very close. People are kind of superstitious in that they will, for example, in a few weeks' time, around the time of Easter, there's the tomb sweeping weekend. And everybody will go, and they'll go and visit their ancestors' graves, or in some ways it feels like a very traditional society, and yet it's hyper modern.
Now, it's a massive population, so the question is, for all of those people, does China work?
It works pretty well. I mean, it certainly works better than it worked for much of the history of China. So if you look at just sort of basic measures of human development, 800 million people have been lifted out of poverty. Absolute poverty is gone now. And although it's not a prosperous society in the way that Western Europe is, it's a pretty comfortable society for many people. And for most other people, they feel as if it's getting better. And so it works it's a very well organized society, partly because of the way in which the central planning works. So what you have is these five-year plans. They've just published a new one. And these plans, they sort of set out a blueprint for what the priorities of the government are. And they'll say, okay, we want to focus on AI, or we want to focus on new material sciences, all these kind of, nanotechnology. They'll identify certain things, or like they did, say, about 10 years ago, they'll say, we want electric vehicles, and we want to be leaders in electric vehicles. So what they did then was they didn't just help people to set up factories, but they also immediately rolled out the charging stations, so that it meant that by the time you were able to buy an electric vehicle, you also had somewhere to charge it. And so right now, for example, in Beijing, I think half of the cars are electric vehicles. And so when you're on the street here, you hear almost nothing half the time. And, people are on these electric scooters as well. And so all of that stuff is really, it works very well. But yet, people are struggling as well. At the moment, you'll meet a lot of people who have either had a pay cut or they've lost their job. And that's partly because you've had a very long housing crisis, kind of a property slump, and people haven't been spending. And so you've got kind of a mixture. You've got in a way two economic stories, one where the long-term stuff is working really well. And then on a day-to-day level, quite a lot of people are having difficulties.
Now, do the people in any sense feel themselves to be downtrodden, ruled by the state, no free will, that kind of thing? Because we saw in COVID when there was an outbreak, they locked everyone up and delivered food as if they were behind bars.
Yeah, funnily enough, actually, during the COVID thing, there were those periods of these lockdowns, which were relatively brief compared to what we had. But the rest of the time, because they had kind of effectively sealed the country off, everybody, when we were all locked down, people in China were busy out going to restaurants and all of that. So you have, people are aware of the fact that it is a society where there are certain things that are not fully free. So, for example, You've got this so-called Great Firewall that a lot of websites on the internet are banned. But then a lot of people have VPNs. And so if there's any film that you kind of, if I mention some film that came out in, you know, in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago, somebody in China will say to me, oh yeah, I watched that on my phone last night. And so, so people, you know, although you've got these rules, and the rules can be enforced in a pretty, you know, emphatic way a lot of the time, nonetheless, people also, you know, they're human. They find ways of getting around them. And I think the other way in which it's a bit different is that because, you know, it's a bit like if, for example, you look at, if you talk to people in Hong Kong, people were used to certain kinds of political freedoms. They never really had democracy because the British never introduced it. But they had got a certain amount of freedom. And some of those freedoms have now been restricted in the last few years. So they feel it. Whereas people in mainland China, they never really enjoyed those kinds of freedoms. And so to that extent, they're not, you know, they don't complain about it. They do notice, for, you know, if, say, the government decides to get more restrictive on something for a while and then to ease things up. But then the last thing I'd say on this is that it's just culturally, it's a place, and it's true of a lot of East Asia, where it's less individualistic than, say, Western Europe. And so people think, you know, of the how the group is doing, and that really starts with the family. So that people are very conscious of how they and the rest of their family, their parents, their grandparents, their siblings, if they have them, that they're part of a kind of a joint project of happiness. And while that means that you can't tell each other what to do, you have to take each other into account. And so, you know, that kind of transfers a bit into people just accepting, well, I can't do whatever I like because the common good demands something else.
Now, when we try to do something here, there are always cries, oh, it's NIMBYism, we don't want it next door to us. You get the impression from outside that in China, if the state wants to build a new children's hospital, for example, they tell everyone on that site, time to move on, we'll find you more housing, but you're out of here because we want to build a hospital. Is that really how it's done? Can you object in China to something that's happening?
You can object, and so, for example, you know, if they want to, you know, to buy every house in the village, and they want you to get out, or they want you to move out, you can say you don't want to, and then they exert, first of all, a kind of peer pressure, and then they'll often you'll get a lot of visits from local party people. They generally speaking, again, kind of culturally prefer not to have a big confrontation. And so, but after a while, most people just get worn down. And then if it really came to it, then they would just move you out. You've had this, you know, it's the biggest experience of urbanization in the history of humankind, where you've really had about sort of 800 or 900 million people moving from the countryside to the cities in the last 40 or 50 years. And so it went from being a predominantly rural society to being a predominantly urban society. And so that obviously means that all kinds of villages just sort of disappear because they build roads and they build railways. But generally speaking, what happens is that they say to you, well, we're going to give you an apartment in a fairly nearby town or city. And this apartment is going to be bigger than the place you lived in, and it's going to have all mod cons. And in fact, they might give you a second apartment. And that's quite useful because it means you can put your mother-in-law in there, or you can put your son or something. And so most people find that they actually prefer moving into something more modern somewhere else. But there obviously will be people who regret it as well.
Now, China is the leading country in 57 out of 64 critical technologies. And we can see it. It's quite apparent when you compare the United States to China that in so many ways China has outpaced supposedly the most skilled and most wealthy economy in the world. How do they do that?
I think part of it is that they, because they've already got this enormous and enormously efficient manufacturing industrial base. So you have, you know, what they developed really from the 1980s onwards was just they created this whole system of every element of the manufacturing process, from the raw materials to the labor to the logistics to everything else. They just developed a system that made it so efficient and so cheap that they were able to do that. And then then what they did was they adapted it. But then they also invest enormously in research and development and in education. So you've got, like, say, 10 million people graduating every year. You've got in the STEM subjects in 2025, the science, technology, engineering, mathematics, you have you had 77,000 PhDs last year alone. This is more than kind of everywhere else put together. And so on the scale of this, and the investment in education, and that education being kind of focused towards a kind of an industrial policy, that means that they, you know, they use what they've got, and they focus on it. And so, for the next few years, for example, they're focusing on making sure that every stage of this process they can do at home, if possible, and they will put whatever investment is necessary into that. And every province, every city, every town, they'll know that they're going to get subsidies from the government, or they're going to get help from the government if they want to keep pushing in this direction. The other thing is that they embrace technology. I spend quite a lot of my time going around visiting factories in China. And you go into, say, a car factory, and they'll tell you 98% of this section is automated. And then they'll say 97% of that. And you just basically, it's machines building machines. And they, of course, operate 24 hours a day. And you know, they've embraced robotics. They're embracing AI. And all of this is part of a sense of, you know, if the technology is there, we're going to go with it. We're going to go ahead with it. And they don't stop to think, is this going to cost people jobs? Because they just think, well, we'll find them other jobs, you know, or it's going to grow the economy. It'll make the place more prosperous.
Now, one of the points we make here when we're trying to do something, you know, we're building metro, it'll take 15 years, or we're building the children's hospital, it took decades finally to get close to the opening day. They seem to do things much more quickly, but also they have the sense that we're not building for the next 100 years. Life's going to change dramatically. So this building, spanking new now, we might have to tear it down in 20 years.
Absolutely. And I think, like, say, with apartment buildings, really people think, you know, if this apartment lasts me for 25 years, that's fine, I'll get another one then. And so they're not really thinking in terms of lasting hundreds of years. But on the subject of children's hospitals, I went to see a children's hospital that was opened just outside Beijing a couple of years ago. And that was six times as big as our children's hospital is going to be. And it had all the things that the children's hospital in Dublin is going to have, with all those nice rooms for parents to stay in and everything else. And from the moment of the conception to the first patient going in was 3 years. And so it really does underscore what you say. When they decide they're going to do it, they do it very quickly. The other factor which I always think is worth mentioning, because it's so obvious and yet nobody mentions it, is Chinese people work very hard. They work very long hours. And there is this sort of work culture called 996, which is like you work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. And it's also part of the culture that if your boss calls you at 11 o'clock on Saturday night, you pick up the phone and you do whatever the boss wants you to do. It's just accepted that the work has to be done. And I know loads of people that are, you know, my friends here, who will be taking holidays, and they're working all the way through the holidays. They literally work every day through the holidays. And that's just the way it is. And so it's kind of like when we sort of think of the American work ethic from Europe, but is that really on steroids over here? And that's part of the explanation.
Now, finally, I should ask you about the people themselves. I mean, at the time of Mao, we know the Cultural Revolution and re-education and all of that, and I suspect a lot of people were utterly miserable. Would you describe the Chinese now as a kind of joyful people, an easygoing people?
The ones I know are pretty joyful and fairly easygoing. I find Chinese people to be very relaxed. They're very funny and they enjoy a laugh. And they're not entirely unlike us in some ways, in that they quite enjoy life. And they also, they're kind of non-confrontational, so that they don't necessarily say to you exactly what they mean in very clear terms. But we're used to that.
Dennis Staunton, China correspondent for the Irish Times. Dennis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.